And now our feature presentation.
Welcome to the Movie Goings Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Wheeler.
And I'm your co-host, Michael Wheeler. Today, we are going to be talking about the 2011 film Attack the Block from director Joe Cornish. Since I picked this movie, Jared, why don't you get us started here?
All right, well, this is a sci-fi coming-of-age horror comedy, which is my favorite genre.
awesome subgenre, anyway.
Yeah, so this is a movie that's basically about what would happen if there was an alien invasion in a low-income area of South London, and the only people around to fight it were teenage punks. it's on one level a really fun kind of action alien invasion movie, and on another level it's quite a lot of other things, as we will talk about. I really enjoy this movie. I first saw it, like, I'd heard a lot about it, and kind of the people involved in it are involved in a lot of things that I love, like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and At World's End, some of my favorite movies. So, you know, I was definitely anxious to see this, and I got it, and I happened to be over at Brett's place, our brother Brett, when I got it, and Ian happened to be visiting, our other brother, and so we all sat around and watched it. I was like, I have this movie, guys, let's watch this. And we all watched it, and I was just like, this is great, I'm loving it. And we get to the end, they were both just like, eh, didn't really do it for me. I was like, what is wrong with you guys? Like, and I still don't, I'm just kind of baffled by their reaction to it. But yeah, I guess we could talk more about kind of the general reaction to it in a minute. But first, Micah, why don't you tell us about kind of why you picked this and what your thoughts are?
I kind of went out on a limb, to be honest. I hadn't seen this movie before. I've been wanting to watch it for quite some time, though just hadn't had the opportunity. I don't know where I was when you guys watched this, but I wish that I had been around. I would have liked to have seen it before now. I'm glad that I have finally seen it. I did really enjoy it. I love the subgenre, horror coming of age subgenre, and this is a great example of it. I don't really know of any other examples of that subgenre, but that's okay. Maybe there ain't.
Well, sci-fi horror comedy is really kind of the wheelhouse of The World's End and Shaun of the Dead, and like they're all about genre blending in really fun ways. So it's definitely of a piece with that family of movies.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, anybody that's seen any of Edgar Wright's trilogy, Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz or At World's End, should be able to experience the movie and enjoy it. I'm sure many of them.
And that reminds me, actually, because, you know, now that I think about it, I watched Hot Fuzz with Ian at some point before that, and he wasn't really into that either, so maybe it's just a problem with his taste. I don't know.
Well, not everybody enjoys those movies, but they are of a piece with one another, I think. So if you do like one of those and haven't seen the others, go watch them. Like I said, I heard about this movie actually before it came out. I did see a trailer for it, and I was like, wow, that looks really fun. And it is. But for one reason or another, I never ended up seeing that. And Jared, is there, I don't know, I don't think that this movie got a super wide release. Why do you think a lot of people didn't end up seeing this movie?
Well, you know, I had to go hunting for it on DVD, obviously. I would have loved to see it in a theater, and it didn't show up in theaters in the U.S. It got a very, very limited run for a very, very limited amount of time in this country, even though it had just, like, done massively well in the festival circuit. It won a bunch of audience awards at the festivals that it showed at. People loved it. And it, you know, it was picked up by a distributor for the U.S. I don't remember which one, but they couldn't figure out how to market it. They couldn't figure out who was going to like it, which blows my mind. But, you know, there was some talk, obviously, we've talked about this. There was some talk of figuring out how to maybe subtitle the movie for showing it, even though it's in English, obviously, because it's in England. The characters are all, they have just these really, really thick accents, and they're using, lower income South London slang that most of the world isn't familiar with. And I guess the idea was that there are lots of points in the movie where their dialogue is basically incomprehensible. I didn't find that to be a problem, and I don't see, like, if they wanted to put subtitles, they could have. That seems a bit silly to me, but they should have, like, if they thought that was the thing to do, they should have done that and showed it anyway. But I don't believe I can't believe they didn't give it a better release than they did.
I mean, at the end of the day, it has aliens. It's kind of a monster movie, but it doesn't play like one. Its intention isn't to be an action movie, and maybe that's one reason why.
I mean, yeah, it has, like, you know, lots of things going on, but it, you know, even when they're, like, yeah, there's a lot less action than you would get in a full-on action movie. There's less horror than you would get in a full-on horror movie. There's less laughs than you get in a full-on comedy movie. But, you know, what I love about it is that in any given scene, you're going to get one of those things. And if you like any of those, if you like those things, then you're, there's always going to be something that you're going to enjoy going on. You know, like I said, audiences responded really well to it. The audiences that actually got to see it. It got best debut film at some festival. It got best soundtrack. has a really fun soundtrack. I especially love the scene at the end, the slow-mo scene. I love the music that's playing over that. It got best international film at the Saturn Awards. So, you know, plenty of acclaim, plenty of, like, it was very marketable, I feel, and they just really dropped the ball.
Well, it kind of reminds me of another, monster movie that also didn't get a whole lot of viewing, The Host. Have you seen that, Jared?
I have. I did not love The Host, I'll be honest.
I think it's a lot of why I compare it is because it has some action and it has some comedy and it has some, like, dramedy, but the point isn't certainly the monster. The monster sort of brings about circumstances that allow the characters to go on a journey, and I think that's what this movie ultimately is. So,
yeah, I that's a good comparison actually with The Host, I think, even though I didn't care for The Host that much. And what I didn't like about The Host, I think this movie does better personally, is just that The Host, when it is genre hopping, it's doing it in very, very drastic ways. Like, the tone is just all over the place. When it's going comedy, it's going hyper silly slapstick, and when it's going horror, it's like super serious, terrible, and it's just like whiplash flipping back and forth between the two. And I think that this is much more subtle, and it blends those genres better together. They don't feel like, you know, different movies from scene to scene.
Right. I can see that. I mean, we're not talking about The Host, but The Host, a lot of the comedy is like physical comedy. So when it's serious, that is just gone, and it's super, like, it's scary even. Whereas in this, like, the right. dialogue is just hilarious throughout, no matter what the circumstances
are. Yeah, even if the characters are terrified, that, you know, they're saying, they'll say funny things or whatever, or they're, you know, yeah. Definitely.
So, like I said, Joe Cornish directed Attack the Block, and he is a regular contributor with Edgar Wright, who, you know, of course...
Yeah, directed. He was a writer on Tintin, the Tintin movie.
Oh, really?
He got pulled in to help write that, along with Edgar Wright, right? They both wrote that, I think. Okay. And along with Stephen Moffat. Like, there was the three of them, Joe Cornish, Edgar Wright, Stephen Moffat. and he was also working with Edgar Wright on Ant-Man before...
All that debacle went south, happened, right?
He's kind of the guiding force behind this movie, the director and the writer, and, you know, he was able to get it produced through Big Talk Productions, which is the Edgar Wright studio that
like production company.
The Cornetto trilogy that we were talking about earlier. So lots of connections there, and of course Nick Frost, the guy who's not Simon Pegg, who appears in all of those movies, is in this as well. In a minorish role,
and not even that memorable of a one. Honestly, I remember him being prominently displayed in the trailers, and he.
Oh yeah, like on the poster, he's like in the big group all standing together, but he's not really involved with that group at all.
Well, it's probably because at the time, especially, he might have been the only recognizable actor in the group.
He basically still is. You know, like I said, there's Nick Frost, and he's the name in this movie, really, basically.
Well, at least until Jodie Star Wars Whittaker, episode 7 comes out.
Right. Well, there's Jodie Whittaker, who's been in a couple things, and you may have seen her, you may not. I have. I don't think she's that big of a name, but she's, you know, I like her, and she's good. But, you know, and I recognized her, but most people wouldn't. And then, of course, like you say, John Boyega, the main character in this, has been cast in Star Wars Episode 7, so he will be a bigger name in a few years than he was, than he is now, and than he was at the time. Certainly, he was. This was the movie that really put him on the map. It was really fun, actually. He won a Best Actor award in the Black Reel Awards, which highlight black actors and black achievements in film. It's been going since 2000, and you know, if you look at the list of other people who have won the Best Actor award, Denzel Washington has won it 4 times. Chiwetel Ejiofor has won it 2x. Morgan Freeman has won it. Forrest Whitaker has won it. So that's some pretty august company.
Yeah, no joke.
For his performance in this movie.
He's really charismatic. He doesn't even say very much, but he's always, he's just got a great presence.
Yeah, he is fantastic.
So, well,
I was very excited when I heard he'd been cast in Star Wars.
I know we're going to talk more about casting in a minute, but back to Joe Cornish and sort of how he got started on this. Jared, you told me about this. He got mugged at one point.
Yes, he was mugged, and that kind of gave him, I don't know how much after the mugging he had the idea for this movie, but the movie begins with a scene of a character being mugged by our main characters, and that's kind of where things start. So that was the inspiration for him, a real life mugging situation.
And he was mugged by a bunch of kids, and he realized at one point, he says, that you know they were kind of as terrified as he was, and that recognition really got him moving forward. And the other inspiration that he cited is actually Signs, which we've talked about on this podcast already.
Yes.
But as he was watching Signs, apparently he wondered, he lives in South London, and he wondered what that same movie would look like in the context of South London, which is, you know, that's the movie.
Yeah. We've brought up some Signs connections in our conversation about this, and I'd like to kind of highlight those again as we go through it. But, you know, I would say this movie compares to Signs, you know, in the best possible way. Like, you know, Signs, we've talked about it and I enjoy it, but I recognize it is not a great movie and has a lot of flaws. And I feel like this movie has far fewer flaws and none of the same flaws that Signs has. I think that this is doing a lot of the things that Signs is doing, and it's doing them better.
Well, for one thing, it's just straightforward. It never pretends to be anything other than what it is. It's just simple, and it doesn't deviate from,
you know, it has themes, it has weight, it has a message, mm-hmm. but it doesn't deploy those with this really heavy hand. It's not trying too hard to shove something down your throat, and it definitely lacks a lot of the major plot holes that Signs has. Well, the major plot hole that Signs has. But it's even smaller scale than Signs, because, you know, Signs, obviously, even though it's localized, you know that this is an invasion that's going on around the world. And in this movie, as far as we can tell, this is happening in this one neighborhood.
Right. And it doesn't, you know, it has a great climax, but it doesn't, it's a climax that doesn't depend on, you know, some crazy plot twist.
Yeah, exactly. There's that connection, you know, and also you can see a lot of other science fiction connections that he has in this movie. He, you know, makes reference to a lot of sci-fi authors. The block, the housing that they live in, the high-rise apartment building is called Wyndham Estates, named after the author of Day of the Triffids, a famous alien invasion in England sci-fi novel.
A lot of the streets that the kids will make reference to are also, you know, taken from other famous sci-fi authors, H.G. Wells, Arthur C. Clarke, and others.
Right, exactly. So this is a movie that is made by people who love science fiction. So that's great, and it really shows.
Yeah.
Lots of Easter eggs there for people who kind of know what to look for.
And so the obvious, it's a sci-fi because it has aliens, and the aliens are really cool. They have
love these aliens.
They have no eyes. They are these massive gorilla / wolf kind of creatures.
Yeah, they're like giant gorilla wolves that run around on all fours and have huge glowing jaws.
Yeah, and
with the giant teeth.
The cool thing about it is that you know, they added some CGI effects in post production, but they had actually, you know, guys in suits apparently who stood in for these things. And
yeah, these are not computer generated monsters. They are, they've been touched up with computer effects, but they are present in the scenes that they are in, which is great. I mean, like, you can just, you can always tell when that's happening in a movie.
The actors, like, were genuinely terrified of these things. and I think that definitely comes across.
You know, and two of the, well, two of the things that they did to the creatures in post-production that, you know, just kind of heightened the effectiveness of the design is they took kind of the blackness, like, because these are black creatures, and they kind of, like, they made it even less reflective, and it made it just, like, this blacker than black. It's like this inky, will swallow you whole kind of blackness, where, like, if it was at a completely dark room and one of these creatures was hiding in the corner, you would be able to see it because it'd be so much blacker than everything else around it.
Right, just sort of swallows up the light around it.
Yeah, and then, you know, in the their jaws, like I said, they glow, have glowing teeth, which is the one part of their bodies that isn't just inky black. So, really great.
And there are no moments in this sci-fi film where I'm like, okay, there's a green screen.
Right.
It's all either, you know, on physical sets or happening, like, in actual locations in South London.
Exactly. So that's great. And speaking of authenticity, you know, the casting, as I told you, was done by, you know, advertising in kind of the low-income neighborhoods, like advertising mm-hmm. their auditions, in the kind of neighborhoods where the characters of the movie live. And so
that shows
most of the actors in the movie are legit, like, council housing teens, who enjoy acting. And so, yeah, you can definitely tell, like, you know, these accents are not put on, or they don't seem that they're put on. Like, these are people who have spent plenty of time around the kinds of people who talk like they talk, like the characters talk. And there's never a moment in the movie where you're just, where you find them unbelievable as characters or unbelievable in terms of the way they're speaking. It's just, yeah, very authentic kind of teenage, I don't know, whatever you'd call it.
I mean, that dialogue, though, or at least the accent, will be a barrier for some. If you're having a hard time with it, I would encourage you to use closed captioning or, you know, toss up the subtitles, because the dialogue, when you can tell what it is hilarious and very well written.
You know, I've never had that much trouble understanding stuff. I know some people who do. I don't feel like you're not gonna have trouble following what's going on.
There's yeah, no, even
gonna,
if you
trouble following
if
the
you
action,
muted it,
you might miss fine. Some good jokes, and that would be a shame. But you're not gonna be confused,
right? Yeah.
So yeah, that just highlights all the more how ridiculous it is that they didn't release this better. But anyway, yeah.
And we were just talking about the casting. I really want to know. So there are these two little kids. You know, the movie follows this gang of teenagers, and these two little kids, who obviously idolize them, pop up every once in a while, and they just steal the show. Like, every time they're there, they're hilarious. I want to know what happened to those kids. Like, are they in other things? Because they need to be.
It's true. I have no idea who they are and no idea where they went. Should look that up sometime. That's, yeah, they are great. They're about, what, like 9 years old or something?
Yeah.
Compared to our characters who are 15, 16 years old.
You know, the nurse character asked him at one point, you know, how old are you, 6? And, you know, rather annoying, you know, they correct her, I'm 9.
Yeah,
Probs and Mayhem is what they go by.
Is there, yeah, that's their handles. And they have, you know, obviously other names that the other characters call them all the time, but they insist on going by their handles. And they actually, you know, they earn that by the end of the movie.
Yeah, in great fashion.
People start calling them that. Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they are great. Anyway.
So, as we start to talk about the themes, I imagine that we're probably going to go ahead and sound the spoiler klaxon here, because I imagine we can't help but get into some spoilers from here on out. So, here we go.
Yeah, that could very well happen. So, good idea. Sound that off. I guess, you know, talk about the characters a bit more, and particularly the main character, John Boyega's character, Moses, and kind of, this is his movie. It's a movie about him. It's a movie about a journey that he takes and about a path that he's on and about how he changes that path. And I think everything in the movie kind of revolves around that. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I mean, he's a really charismatic actor, and it would have been a lesser film without him, I think, because he does hold it all together, much as he, you know, holds this little gang family together. I hadn't really thought of it as a coming of age story for some reason. I mean, it certainly happens, and I recognize it as soon as you said it. I was like, oh, of course. But we see him very much in contrast to especially one of the adult characters who ends up being an antagonist for much of the film, who essentially, as you pointed out, is Moses 10 years later.
Right, so this is High Hats, who is a gangster, he's basically the local crime lord. You know, he's probably like 25, 26 years old or something like that, but he's kind of the local drug dealer. He's got his crew that rolls around with him, and he runs kind of the local drug trade. He's got weed growing at the top of the apartment building, and he kind of doles out the drugs to the people. And early on in the film, he hands Moses a stash of drugs and says, go sell this, get this much money for it, for me out of it. And he's obviously, you know, already kind of roping him in to the gang. He's like, he kind of looks at him, and he's like sizing him up, and he decides that, he kind of sees Moses, I think, as a potential rival if he doesn't bring him in now. And he's kind of been watching him, and I think he watches, you know, all of the kids in the block probably this way, where it's like, okay, I'm going to watch and see when they get to a point where I can rope them in, and where if I don't, they might grow into be a threat to me someday. So he kind of brings him in, and he kind of gives him this little speech about, this is my block, I own this place, you cross me and you're going to suffer. And circumstances kind of lead Moses to cross him, kind of almost basically by accident, just because of the craziness of what's going on. And so Hi-Hats just kind of gets tunnel vision about that and spends the rest of the movie kind of chase him down.
Yeah.
To reestablish the authority that he thinks he's lost.
In the midst of an alien invasion where he needs to be focusing on this external threat, but he just can't see it because, you know, they're not as much of a threat in his mind to his little corner of the universe as, you know, John Boyega's character.
Right. And yeah, and Moses, you know, obviously is very much on this path already, really. I act like Hi-Hats is kind of drawing him into something that he wouldn't be in otherwise. You know, the movie begins with him leading his gang and mugging Sam, who's a young nurse, who's walking home alone at night. Probably not a good idea for her to do, but, you know.
Especially in that area of town.
It's not her fault that she gets mugged, obviously. And so, you know, that's the opening scene. She's walking home, and they kind of confront her in the street and take her stuff and send her on her way. And so that's kind of how we get introduced to Moses' character. And that's not a particularly sympathetic introduction. You know, he's mugging a defenseless woman.
Backed up by, you know, four or five other boys.
Thugs, basically, yeah. But we can immediately tell kind of how young they are. And as far as I can tell, this is the first time that they've ever mugged anyone. You know,
that may or may not be true, but I think the point still remains.
They're clearly not pros at it. That's for sure. Right. This is not something that they're good at or that they're even really comfortable with yet. It's almost like they're kind of trying it on for size. You know, maybe they were just, I don't know why they're doing it. I don't know why they've decided this night that they're going to do it. They're just bored or whatever. And we should mention that this is Guy Fawkes night. So there's, this is happening, you know, with, there's fireworks going on everywhere, all in different parts of the city and stuff like that, which kind of serves to mask the alien invasion that's happening. Sorry, I just kind of really topic jumped there, but that just came to mind.
Oh, I don't know that I recognized that, actually. That must have been something I missed in the dialogue.
You know, I missed it, honestly, the first time I saw the movie, and then when I was rewatching it, I was like, why are... Because it's, you know, we grew up in Guatemala, fireworks is not all that weird, but you don't have fireworks every night in London. And I was like, why are there fireworks going off? And I kind of listened for it and checked in. I can't remember when they say it, but it's that's the night. That's when it is.
Okay. Well, and just to, and that was definitely worth mentioning, but just to jump back to where we were, I mean, a big theme of the movie for sure. I mean, just as we follow Moses, you know, sort of coming to age, a lot of that is just him coming to grips with the consequences of his actions and, not only
and realizing that there are consequences,
right? That there are consequences, right? And I mean, they at one point, I think they do reference, I mean, that they were sort of acting out of boredom and that they lament not just staying home and playing FIFA.
Right. Yeah, that's a great moment. When I like, you know, John Boyega's character does seem older than he actually is, and that's partially because John Boyega, the actor, was older than the character he's playing, but I think that his casting, you know, a lot of times in Hollywood, well, this isn't Hollywood, but a lot of times in movies, you have adults playing high schoolers, and I think this is less a case of that and more a case of him being deliberately cast a bit older because his character is supposed to seem older than he is because his circumstances have forced him to grow up faster than he should have. And at one point, Sam asks him how old he is. Oh, that's right, because she goes down to his flat to get something because he can't go down there. And she's kind of going through and she looks into a bedroom and she sees, I think it's like some Spider-Man sheets on a bed or something. Yeah. She's like, oh, do you have a little brother? And he's like, no, it's just me. And she's like, how old are you? And I think he's 15, right?
Yeah, but he's essentially had to fend for himself because the only authority figure in his life that we know of is this uncle that lives with him, but is sort of
just
in
never
and
around,
out.
Right?
So
he's
had to fend for himself. Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, so that all this contributes to kind of her realization. She has, you know, she has this really weird moment kind of over the phone where you can kind of see kind of this light go on in her head. She's like, oh, he's just a kid, basically. But yeah, so obviously the coming of age for me moment comes when he kind of realizes this is my fault. I caused this situation. People are dead, including some of my friends, because of decisions that I made. Just because of the kind of this persona that I was trying to pursue that wasn't a good path for me. And so now I need to be the one to fix this. And that's kind of the far point of his arc in this movie.
Yeah. And as you may or may not have seen the movie and we've already set off the spoiler klaxon, let's talk about that. So, at the beginning of the movie, you know, they mug someone, and then as actually the mugging is still in, is still happening.
All right, it gets interrupted by
that,
doesn't
alien,
it?
Right, an alien comes crashing to Earth, and it ends up being...
It lands on a car
female.
Next to them, and that's what kind of causes
right,
a distraction
they
for the person
it.
They're mugging to kind of run away.
Right, but it ends up that alien that they end up killing and getting some.
And it's not just
her.
Them, it's Moses particularly. Moses is like, I'm gonna get me some, and he like just beats it down
pursues
with a baseball
it.
Bat.
Right, like hunts it down.
And they all think that this is great fun, right? Like it's this crazy looking creature, and it just like he reaches into the car because the car gets bashed open, and he's like, oh, there might be something valuable to steal. And the alien slashes his face and then runs off. And they're like, we're going on the hunt. They go, you know, racing off through the night to track this thing down. So he beats it down and he carries it off with him. And it turns out that this is the female alien of the species. And all of the other aliens that crash are the males of the species. And they want to mate with the female. So the female body is giving off these pheromones as they carry it around with them that is drawing the male aliens to them wherever they go.
So his action, you know, has had this consequence, and his friends have died as a result of him doing this thing. And I think this may be the first time that he's gotten a real taste of, you know, well, even the idea that there are consequences.
Right, because, yeah, that's children and teenagers. That's one of the big kind of transitions to adulthood is this idea of what I do matters, and I should think about someone besides myself when I do things.
Yeah.
So, and you know, as we're saying, there's the whole, like, female alien, male aliens, pheromones, etc. Like, how do we know this is going on? Because it's a great idea. It's a great motivation for the aliens and everything. But once you have that as your idea, and these are aliens that don't talk, obviously, how do you kind of get your characters to realize this is what's going on and convey that to the audience without having like this clumsy expositional dialogue. And I think they do some really fun, subtle things with that. Very early on in the movie, they're sitting upstairs in an apartment, and there's like a Discovery Channel nature program playing that's talking about moths that give off pheromones that draw their mates in, and that kind of drops that little hint there. And then later on, one of these random characters, do you say he was a zoology major, or was that just like a class he was in?
Yeah, I think he took some college courses some point.
And so he just has this random idea. Like, it's a little silly, obviously, but at the same time, like, it's a very effective kind of, like, what if this is happening? And, you know, in, like, 30 seconds, he kind of explains what he thinks might be going on, and then we move on from there. They don't really dwell on it, but that's how they kind of realize what's happening. And that character, incidentally, who's this kind of, he's a skinny white guy in his 20s who's kind of scared of his own shadow half the time when he's not stoned out of his mind. He's based on Joe Cornish at that age.
Yeah. And, you know, desperately, it must be noted, wants affirmation from this group of kids.
Yeah, that is funny. I love that, you know, that this is inspired by him getting mugged, and yet he takes that thing that happened to him and turns it into a movie about them instead, and a movie that's very sympathetic to them. I think that shows a very, I don't know, a very interesting kind of artistic, empathetic view of the world on his part.
Yeah, a willingness to try to figure out
to get inside,
like,
somebody else's
kind
head.
Of action
yeah,
comes
exactly.
From.
Really yeah. Great.
And I really like that, you know, he really lays out the circumstances that, I mean, these kids, we've already talked about how this gangster that we're introduced to, who is a major antagonist, is essentially, I mean, he is, that's the path that is laid out for Moses, and his gang will likely, you know, one day be just, you know, thugs that are working with him / for him. But these circumstances sort of intervene and give them an opportunity to act in a way that is, I mean, truly heroic, and gives them sort of a way to realize that there is another way.
Yeah, you know, like they're following a very stereotypical narrative of kind of, you know, this vicious cycle of kind of crime and violence and everything, and this movie provides them with another narrative in which they are the heroes that they never thought they could be, especially Moses, who just gets, like, this really great, I mean, he gets the full-on, like, slow-mo explosions, dangling action set piece hero moment at the end there.
You know, and the crowd chanting his name. But that's, you know, a far cry from the reaction of their female friends when they hear, you know, that they have mugged this woman, you know, five of them against one.
They're disgusted by it,
you know, and they sort of see themselves aright in that moment.
Right, yeah. And, you know, you can see when Moses has kind of had his heroic moment and he's sitting in the police van and everything, and they're all chanting his name. Like, you can see this switch flip in his head, and you can almost, you know, see that transformation from, this was what I was going to be, to, like, I can be something else.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's...
this is a really great moment. Cool. You know, but that subtext, I mean, it seems obvious, but I'm pretty sure... I mean, it's... I do think it's easy to miss.
It is easy to miss because I completely missed it, honestly, the first time I watched the movie. Because the first time I watched the movie, I was watching a sci-fi horror action comedy. And I didn't know, you know, so much the coming of age stuff, and it was just like, it was just a fun movie, and it was only on rewatching it that I kind of started picking up on kind of the other stuff that the movie has going on, and it's got a lot of good stuff going on under the surface of that, just pure entertainment.
Yeah. So I would definitely recommend it. It's great how, I mean, if nothing else, just that theme of You know, these characters sort of, you know, it introduces us to them, and they are exactly what
we
expect.
Well, and I
want
to talk about
to
some of those supporting characters, too, especially, well, I want to talk about his friends, and I want to talk about kind of the other characters that are floating around, too, because there are a lot of really great characters.
Also, that nurse character that they mug.
Who comes in again. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, there's his gang. I have their names written down here. I mean, it's not
Pest.
Like they yeah, Pest is the mouth of the group, for sure. And then there's Dennis, Jerome, and Biggs. And at the beginning of the movie, it would be easy to, you know, kind of have a hard time telling these characters apart, maybe, in some ways. Just like which one is which and who's what. But they definitely develop kind of distinct personalities over the course of the movie, as you get to know them. And they kind of do their own thing. I mean, Pest is obviously, he gets all of the best lines.
He makes his presence
yeah.
known.
Yeah, you know, I love the moment, you know, they end up because the nurse that they've mugged happens to live in the same apartment building as they do, which they did not realize. But they end up kind of crashing her apartment when they're on the run from the aliens, and she, of course, thinks they're back to rob her again, and she has nothing in her apartment to defend herself. She grabs a guitar and kind of holds it over her head like she's going to beat them with it, and they're just like, we're not here for that. Like, they don't even care that she's doing that. They're just like, why do you think that we're going to do that? But I love that, yeah, I think Pest says at that point, this ain't got nothing to do with gangs or drugs or rap music or violence in video games. which is a great, I think, meta statement, just in general about kind of all of the common sources that we like to blame for those sorts of things going on. But anyway, yeah.
Well, in that very same scene, she's just, you know, roundly cussing them out. and, you know, Pest, of course, like, calls her out for having a potty mouth, which is hilarious. Because it's, again, you know, calling upon the stereotypes, because these kids spend the entire movie just swearing up, you know, up one side and down the other.
Oh, yes. I mean, this movie could be rated R for language,
to, you know?
If it wasn't rated R for other things as well. Like, it's definitely a hard R in terms of profanity, which is not something
sure.
we have had in a movie we've talked about before, so I suppose it's probably a good idea to mention that.
Yeah, but it's part and parcel with the accents, with the dialogue. You expect these kids to be swearing as much as they do. It doesn't seem strange, but they sort of, you know, call out that you know, you're a white nurse. You're not supposed to be swearing like us.
It is funny, yeah, because she's definitely. She seems like she's from a higher place in the class system, I guess. That's how they feel about her, and that's why they picked her to mug her, not realizing that she's not rich.
She lives in their block.
so you know, they are kids who have undoubtedly been victims of stereotyping at some point in their lives, and they are certainly quick to view other people through those same lenses, and the movie, I think, is all about kind of transcending those stereotypes in a lot of ways, which is cool. But yeah, I love, you know, kind of what I love their reactions to things kind of throughout the movie, because it's so believable, I guess, that this is exactly what you would expect a group of teenagers to do just at any given point in the movie. Like, a lot of times in horror movies or action movies or sci-fi movies or whatever, especially ones where people end up dead, it's usually they end up dead because they do really stupid things that you're just like, why would you react to that situation that way? That was really, really dumb. And you're just sitting there kind of yelling at the screen and annoyed.
Like, don't go.
Yeah, exactly.
That
and they don't do
downstairs.
That. Like, they do things exactly the way you would probably do them. And they don't just march stupidly into danger. Like, they get scared and they realize when they're probably outmatched, and they run. Like, they after they beat up, because the female alien, I should mention, is very small compared to the male aliens that show up later, and it's, you know, kind of this grayish color, and it's, you know, they can carry it around with them, basically. The male aliens are 3, 4, or 5 times bigger.
Because we're calling them, you know, they're gorillas.
And so, you know, so they carry this alien off, and they go store it in Ron's weed room, which, as one character describes, is a big room full of weed, and it's Ron's. Ron being the Nick Frost character, and it's his weed room technically, but it's where Hi-Hats grows and stores his weed, so Hi-Hats is really the boss here. But anyway, so So they're up in Ron's flat, looking for a place to store this female alien that they've killed, that they don't even necessarily realize for sure is an alien yet, and they see more of these things landing. And Ron just thinks that it's fireworks, because there's fireworks going off everywhere, but they realize that it's not. So they go out, they want to hunt some more of these things, because it was such an easy kill. So they go arm themselves, and, you know, they all go running into their apartments, and they start, you know, they pull out baseball bats, and one of them's got a katana, and this is the one point in the movie where we kind of see the home life, kind of, for most of them. One lives with his grandmother, you know, and you kind of have parents who are present but not necessarily engaged. They're like, make sure you're back by this hour, but they're not really asking where they're going or what they're doing. But, you know, one of them grabs fireworks and this and that, and they all go running out to the park to try and find one of these things, but then they see one from far away, and it's much bigger and much scarier, and they're like, maybe we're not equipped for this. And they kind of turn tail and run off. So, you know, yeah, that's really great. And, you know, and speaking of combating the aliens, we talked about Probs and Mayhem, the little kids, the weapon that they come up with. Like, you see them when they realize what's going on as well, they want to join in, but of course they're never allowed to join in with the older characters. But you see them kind of do their own thing, and they're marching around carrying fireworks and a super soaker. And it's just kind of comically, it's like, oh no, these kids are going to get themselves killed because they think they're not taking the, they think this is just a game and they're just messing around. And then they end up rescuing one of the older characters because the super soaker is actually full of gasoline. So they soak one of the aliens in, shoot a flare at it, and light it on fire, which is amazing. It's hilarious because it's simultaneously one of the best, most effective, smartest weapons that anybody in the movie comes up with, and yet totally believable as something that a 9-year-old would come up with as a weapon.
Think of, right. Well, and one of the characters specifically dies because I think he underestimates those kids, in the sense that he assumes that what they have, you know, what they're carrying around are toys, and he grabs the only thing of theirs that looks like it's not a toy, and it's the only thing that ends up actually being a toy.
Oh, right. Yeah, one of the older characters.
It's like, it's a cat gun.
He thinks it's a real gun. He thinks they're carrying around a real gun. He's like, give me that. And then the aliens burst in, and he aims and fires, and it pops, and he's just like, oh.
Oh, shoot.
And speaking of, you know, kind of like failed heroism or whatever, I guess, there's that great moment where they're hiding out in the girls' apartment, all of their female friends, and the aliens burst in, and everybody goes and hides, and Moses is kind of hiding behind the couch, and he's got this katana that he took from one of the other guys, who's dead now, I think, at that point. And yeah. So he turns around and raises the sword up over his head to bring it down on the alien, and gets it stuck in the wall behind him and can't get it out. And it's Sam, the nurse, actually ends up saving him. She runs up and sticks a knife, like a kitchen knife, into the thing's head. What are the other creative weapons? Oh, I love when one of the girls grabs a lamp that's plugged in and bashes the light bulb off and, like, zaps one of the creatures with it.
Yeah, and, I mean, in that scene, you know, the boys, you know, you would think would be the ones who come through and, like, kill the aliens, but actually the girls kill
Yeah,
all
they're
the
not
aliens.
Leading the charge.
Well, the guys are, like, cowering. Like,
diving
or,
for
like,
cover.
Messing up.
And or failing.
Yeah. Yeah. Which you don't see often enough.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, very believable stuff going on, even amidst crazy alien invasion. The human element is believable, which is always really important in a movie like this.
And I feel like the last thing that's developed.
Yeah, yeah,
if it
exactly.
is developed.
So yeah, lots of great characters, even if they don't appear very much, I think they all kind of make an impression. Lots of kind of little groups of characters here and there that we follow throughout the movie. You know, there's the main gang, and then there's, like, the two kids, and then there's Ron in his weed room, and Bruce, I think, is the guy's name, who's, like, the skinny...
The Joe Cornish
the
character.
Stoner character who's up there with Ron sometimes. And Sam, the nurse, and the girls that are friends with the guys in the gang. And, you know, all these characters kind of have their little moments in the movie, and they're all pretty great.
Yeah. And You did have an advisory a minute ago about the language. The movie obviously has a lot of action and a lot of violence, but it has some really bloody moments. Not many, but a few.
Yeah, you know, like in a zombie movie. A zombie movie isn't a true zombie movie unless you've got a character who gets his intestines ripped out on the screen. And this movie has a similar moment. It's not intestines, but it's like the flesh being ripped off of a body. So it doesn't particularly dwell on it, but it's definitely there. And, you know, it's part of the genre trappings. It's just one of the things that happens in this kind of movie. And so they check that box.
Yeah. So, if you're still with us, you if you had been watching the movie instead, you'd be halfway through at this point. So it's not a long movie. It's only 90 minutes long. So really do encourage you. It's a really fun 90 minutes. I didn't feel, like I said, it's short, but I didn't even feel like it was that as long as it was. So it's a good use of time, I think, and a lot of fun for all the reasons that we've talked about.
Absolutely. And I think it's a real testament to the quality of the movie that we can have a conversation about it for this long. Even though a lot of people, I think, would see it as just kind of purely light entertainment. There's a lot more going on under the surface. And
for sure.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you guys could be with us as well for this conversation. We enjoyed having it. I hope you enjoyed listening to it.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
And that concludes another episode of the Movie Goings Podcast. See you again soon.
Sorry, buddy. Show's over.